I'm very pleased to be able to introduce the second speaker. This is Professor Moshe Postol, University of Chicago. He's author of many important scholarly works, books, and articles, including Time, Labor, and Social Domination, A Reinterpretation of Marxist Critical Theory, History and Heteronomy, and co-editor of a volume entitled Catastrophe and Meaning, The Holocaust in the 20th Century. And today, presently, Professor Postol will speak on the subject of Israel, the Left, and the crisis of the late 1960s.
Refers back to some of the questions that were raised after Mitchell's talk. Although my talk is going to cover a huge span. As is well known, the Western left tended to regard Israel sympathetically as generally progressive between 1948 and 1967, a period during which the Palestinians remained generally invisible to the world. The war of 1967 and its aftermath marked a fundamental reversal in this regard. Since then, Israel has become viewed increasingly negatively, whereas Palestinians have come to represent anti-hegemonic resistance. This change entailed not only a reversal, but also a shift to an entirely new level of significance. Whereas before 1967, the struggle between Israel and the Palestinians and various Arab states was generally treated as one among many struggles in the world, it has since increasingly become invested with global significance, certainly among many on the left, a significance that seems to far exceed that of the struggle itself. At issue is not whether Israeli policies can be criticized, although, of course, the Israeli right-wing government will insist that any criticisms of their policies is anti-Semitic. Rather, or I would argue that Israeli policies should be criticized, especially those aimed at undermining any possibility of a viable Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza. However, the critique of Zionism, prevalent in many anti-imperialist circles, goes far beyond the critique of Israeli policies. It attributes to Israel and the Zionists a unique malevolence and global conspiratorial power. In this talk, I hope to interrogate aspects of this transformation and relate it to larger historical changes. More specifically, I'd like to suggest that responses to Israel have shifted with the changing configuration of capitalist modernity from the state-centered configurations of the 1950s and 1960s to a subsequent neoliberal global phase. The historical changes in the nature of those responses, I suggest, can be illuminated by a theory of capital on the one hand and anti-Semitism on the other. Why a theory of capital? Eric Hobsbawm, the British historian, has characterized the 20th century in terms of three overarching periods. The first, from 1914 to 1945, is what he called the Age of Catastrophe, marked by two world wars, the Great Depression, the rise of fascism, Stalinism, Nazism, and by the Holocaust. A Fordist golden age followed, lasting until the early 1970s, characterized by high rates of economic growth, the expansion of welfare states, relative political stability, and worldwide processes of decolonialization. This process ended in the 1970s, followed by a new crisis-ridden configuration, marked by the increased mobility of capital and of labor, growing social differentiation and unemployment, the rise of new centers of capital accumulation, and catastrophic downturns in parts of the world. These general developments can be seen with reference to the rise and decline of the state-centered organization of social and economic life from the First World War until the crisis of the 1970s, followed by the emergence of a neoliberal global order. What is important about this general trajectory, and the reason why I mention it, is that it's global, encompassing Western capitalist countries and communist countries, as well as colonized lands and decolonized countries, which suggests that it is not simply an imposition by historians on a formless reality, but delineates a historical reality. When viewed with reference to this overarching trajectory, national differences in policies and paths appear as different inflections of a common pattern rather than as fundamentally different developments. The general and global character of this large-scale historical pattern suggests the existence of overarching structures of imperatives and constraints that is historically dynamic and that cannot be explained in local and contingent terms. The existence of such a historical dynamic, then, expresses a form of imminent necessity that is, I would say, a form of unfreedom. This form of unfreedom, I suggest, is the primary concern of the theory of capital. Rather than deny the existence of historical unfreedom with reference to contingency, such a critical theory seeks to ground that unfreedom and focus on the possibility of overcoming it. The theory of capital, with which I hope to indirectly illuminate changing responses to Israel, is not, moreover, narrowly economic, delineating a presumed material base of social life, but delineates forms of social being that are both social and cultural, objective and subjective. Within this framework, the fundamental forms that structure capitalist modernity are characterized by a dualism, an opposition between concrete particularity and abstract universality. This opposition, I suggest, is neither ontologically given, but is a function of the historically specific social forms that are constitutive of capitalist modernity. Such an analysis, then, grasps both terms of the opposition as being part and parcel of this all. By suggesting that both terms and their opposition remain imminent to capitalism, this approach can also problematize a historical shift that has occurred in recent decades from the predominance of critiques based on abstract universalism, associated, for example, with classic working class movements, to those focused on concrete particularity, expressed, for example, by liberation struggles that can be deemed anti-colonial in the broadest sense. This shift is related to the changing responses by the left to Israel since 1945. I would also suggest that it illuminates the limits of the left in terms of its most fundamental understanding as a practical and theoretical critique of the existing order. Now, what ties together these various elements, and this might sound surprising, in my view, is the issue of anti-Semitism, for which, as I've argued elsewhere, the opposition of abstract universality and concrete particularity is constitutive, is at its heart. Modern anti-Semitism is frequently and mistakenly understood simply as a form of racism. It does have in common with other forms of essentializing discourse, such as racism, an understanding of social and historical phenomena in innate biological or cultural terms. Yet, whereas most forms of racism attribute concrete physical and sexual power to another that is considered inferior, modern antisemitism does not treat the Jews as inferior, but as extremely powerful purveyors of evil. Moreover, the power attributed to the Jews is not concrete and physical, but is abstract, universal, intangible, and global. The Jews within this framework constitute an immensely powerful, invisible international conspiracy that seeks to control the world. Modern antisemitism, then, is not simply a form of prejudice directed against a minority group, but, building on earlier forms of antisemitism, provides a framework for understanding the extremely complex and historically dynamic world of modern capitalism. As a worldview, it is distinguished by its populist, anti-hegemonic, and anti-global character. As I've argued elsewhere, it reifies in concretistic terms the abstract, temporally dynamic global domination of capital, which subjects people to the compulsion of historical forces that they can't grasp directly. It reifies this as the domination of international Jewry. Antisemitism, then, does not treat the Jews as an inferior group, but as constituting an evil, destructive power. Within this Manichaean worldview, the struggle against the Jews is a struggle for human emancipation. And elsewhere I've written that I don't think you can understand the difference between mass murder and extermination without understanding the degree to which the Jews were accorded a power and therefore had to be eliminated. Because antisemitism can appear to be anti-hegemonic and hence emancipatory, it can blur the differences between what I would characterize as reactionary and progressive social critiques of capitalist modernity. For this reason, and I'll recur to the same figure that Nietzsche did, the German social democratic leader August Bebel characterized it admonishingly as the socialism of fools. In its most recent manifestation, it could be characterized as the anti-imperialism of fools. Antisemitism fuses the deeply reactionary with the apparently emancipatory in an explosive amalgam. I'd also like to suggest that modern antisemitism and the historical dynamic of capital are related, and that the prevalence of antisemitism as an explanatory worldview varies with changes in the historical configuration of capital. Let me briefly elaborate by noting a sea change in interpretations of Nazism after 1945. During the first post-war period, that is, of the so-called Golden Age of Fordism, National Socialism frequently was interpreted as a revolt against modernity. After the early 1970s, however, Nazism became regarded as fundamentally modern. This reversal was related to the general issue of how history was understood. To say that antisemitism misrecognizes capitalism's globalizing dynamic in terms of an invisible global Jewish conspiracy suggests that the anti-Semitic struggle against the Jews can be interpreted as an attempt to overcome processes of ongoing historical change that seem to be beyond the control of people. This anti-Semitic worldview, so prevalent during the first half of the 20th century, waned during the post-war Golden Age. Following a transition period marked by increased repression, the show trials in Eastern Europe, McCarthyism in the United States, the rapid economic growth of the 1950s and 1960s in both the Keynesian West and the post-Stalinist East appear to indicate that the long crisis of capitalist modernity had finally been resolved. People, it seemed, had learned to control historical development without having recourse to terror. From the standpoint of this era, after World War II until the early 70s, history seemed to be tamed. It no longer posed a threat, but appeared as positive progress, as modern progress. Nazism's revolt against history, then, could be regarded as anti-modern, as a regression, as a German aberration. The apparently linear triumph of modernity in the 50s and 60s was undermined at the beginning of the 1970s. With the crisis of that decade, the historical dynamic of capitalism began to reemerge overtly beyond the control of national state structures. Parallel to these changes, an intellectual shift also occurred, intending to critique what was called the master narratives of modernity, of the universal, and an affirmative turn to particularism. History became revalued as an expression of domination. Within the framework of this shift, Nazism once again became seen as the other of critical discourse, this time as an extreme example of the modern. I'm suggesting, then, that changes in interpretations of Nazism are related to changing responses to history, to the historical dynamics of capitalist modernity, and that these map onto the overarching periods of recent history outlined by Hobsbawm. These periods also entail significant shifts with regard to ideals associated with abstract universality and concrete particularity, and this in turn is relevant for considering the historical vicissitudes of attitudes toward Zionism, as well as, in the background, the issue of antisemitism. I mentioned earlier that during the first post-war period, Israel was generally regarded positively by the left. It should be noted that in large measure, Israel was celebrated during this period as a modernist, even socialist project, an attitude that went hand in hand with the post-war hegemony of abstract universal ideals. The other side of this universalist coin was that the Holocaust was marginalized to a remarkable degree. It seems clear that processes of denial and repression played an important role in such marginalization, especially, ironically, in Israel, Germany, and Austria. Another very significant global factor in this marginalization was, of course, the Cold War. In the late 1940s, the recent past was quickly submerged by a new global struggle. Yet, however important such processes and developments were, they do not fully account for the general discursive situation in both East and West, namely that after 1945, the extermination of Jews as Jews was almost universally ignored. In Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, the official ideology regarded Nazism simply as fascism, which in turn was understood merely as a tool of capitalism directed against the working classes and against communism. Antisemitism was viewed as a secondary problem, a diversionary tactic. This understanding of Nazism afforded little conceptual space for dealing with the Holocaust. It's noteworthy that although many monuments to the victims of Nazism were erected in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, almost none of them mentioned the Jews. Instead, Jews, who after all were killed as Jews, are referred to as, and I'm quoting, peaceful Soviet citizens or victims of fascism, thereby eradicating the specificity of the Holocaust and of the Jews as victims of attempted extermination, by dissolving that specificity in abstract universalist categories. One could point to many factors that might help explain this situation in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, including the abstract universalism of communist ideology, according to which a specific focus on the victimization of the Jews would be particularistic. That the Jews were particular targets of genocide was, however, also not generally recognized in the West. In France, for example, in 1948, a law was passed according to which the term deportee could be applied only to those who were deported for political reasons. In fact, the term was also applied to Jews, so that surreally, Jewish children sent to Auschwitz were described as political deportees. In Alain Resnais's award-winning film Night and Fog from 1955, political deportees, deportees to do forced labor, and Jewish deportees sent to their death are all conflated. The film shows piles of shoes and other articles taken from Jews at Auschwitz, but does so without mentioning the Jews or the Holocaust. These examples suggest that various local and contingent factors don't sufficiently explain the marginalization of Holocaust discourse during the first two post-war decades. It could be argued that this complete submergence of the specificity of the Holocaust, that the Jews were killed as Jews, was the expression of a certain form of universalism that understood itself as the opposite of Nazism and regarded any mention of the Jews to be unacceptably particularistic. In the immediate post-war period, this emphatic affirmation of universalism was not yet hegemonic. During the most virulent phase of the Cold War, in the late 1940s and early 1950s, each side viewed itself threatened by a shadowy global conspiracy. Each camp viewed its foe as pervasive and intangible, that is, as abstract. This reaction against the universal in the immediate post-war period, this last gasp of the interwar period, was expressed by the show trials in Eastern Europe and McCarthyism in the United States. In the most famous show trial, for those of you who don't know about this, I thought I would go into some detail. The most famous show trial in East Central Europe was held in Prague in 1952. 11 of the 14 accused were Jews, including Rudolf Slansky, who was the Secretary General of the Czechoslovak Communist Party. The charges against them were classically anti-Semitic. The accused were characterized as ruthless cosmopolitans and agents of nefarious international forces, namely the CIA and, suddenly, Zionism. Unable for ideological reasons to refer to international Jewry, the communist regime, the late Stalinist regime, used the word Zionism to fulfill the same function. Such accusations became widespread between 1948 and 1953, culminating in the so-called uncovering of the Doctor's Plot in Moscow, a purportedly international Zionist plot that aimed to poison the entire Soviet leadership. The regime, as we now know, began making plans for the mass roundup of Soviet Jews and started to build camps. These plans were abruptly dropped with the death of Stalin in March 1953. Having first bracketed the Holocaust in the name of universality, the communist world now recapitulated the anti-Semitic attack on Jews as constituting an international conspiracy that posed a danger to humanity. The authorities now termed this conspiracy Zionism. The accusations made were not contingently directed against Jews, but against Jews as the embodiment of an abstract universal conspiracy that would undermine the people's community. Note that this anti-Zionism had little in common with earlier communist critiques of Zionism as bourgeois nationalism, that is, as particularistic. So the word remains the same, but the content of the communist critique of Zionism has really gone 180-degree change. So why it's very difficult to talk about just a straight linearity of the left and Zionism. At this point, I would argue at the latest, the end point of Stalin's socialism in one country revealed itself as, in essence, a form of national socialism. To jump ahead for a moment, the revival of the late Stalinist usage of Zionism in recent decades and the resulting conflation of anti-Zionism referring to a critique of actually existing Israeli policies and institutions, and anti-Zionism as anti-Semitism by another name, has seriously distorted discussion of the contemporary Middle East. This turn against cosmopolitanism, of course, at the time was not restricted to the Soviet bloc. On a much less terroristic level, with less openly anti-Semitic language, McCarthyism in the United States signaled a similar turn against cosmopolitanism, against international communism, which frequently was associated with the Jews. This anti-cosmopolitanism abated or was pushed underground after the mid-1950s. With the regularization of the Cold War after 1953, the universal threat perceived by each side diminished. What emerged was a global order structured by competing international blocs of national states, each of which promoted a set of fetishized, abstract, universal values, liberty versus equality. With all of their differences, both camps based themselves on linear conceptions of progress associated with productivist visions of development in which large-scale bureaucratic organizations mediated production and distribution. That is, in both cases, social organization was seen to be rationally organized according to universal general principles. This post-war synthesis, which became associated with purportedly universalist values, began to be called into question in the late 1960s and early 1970s as Fordism, pushing against its limits, began to unravel. One dimension of this historical shift was political and cultural, expressed by the rise of new social movements of racial minorities, students, youth, women, gays, that criticized, in the name of qualitative specificity, abstract universality as a mode of domination. This shifting historical context also entailed discursive shifts regarding the Holocaust and Zionism. In the early and mid-1960s, novels, plays, and historical works appeared that began to address the specificity of the Holocaust. This shift, I would suggest, could be understood as one facet of a more general transformation that began to point beyond the extant order and rendered imaginable the overcoming of the antinomy of abstract universalism and concrete particularity, and its supersession by a new form of universality that could recognize difference. At the same time, the logic of the existing order, I would argue, continued to reproduce this opposition. These various possibilities were expressed in newer discourses on the Holocaust, which ranged enormously from positions that suggest, at least implicitly, a different form of universality, to discourses that have been very particularistic in their focus on the Holocaust, and which have been used, for example, as an ideology of legitimation for the policies of Israeli governments. A similar tension can also be found among a range of movements that emerged at the time. Some, I would argue, such as then socialist feminist movements, sought to get beyond the dichotomy of universalism and particularity, however implicitly. Others, such as black nationalists and many radical feminist groups, simply reproduced the dichotomy, choosing the side of particularism. This arguably also became the case with many forms of anti-imperialism, which increasingly have tended to valorize the nationalism of groups deemed other as the revolt of authentic, concrete particularity against the homogenizing dynamism of abstract domination. Such domination has become reified discursively as the domination of the United States and, in many cases, what is called Zionism. Let me begin to problematize this complex of issues. The break effected by the new social movements of the late 1960s was related, I would argue, to a historical transformation of the overarching organization of social and economic life. The late 1960s was a crucial historical moment in this regard, one when the order that had superseded laissez-faire capitalism, the state-centered welfare state in the West, and actually existing socialist equivalent in the East, ran up against their historical limits and were fundamentally called into question. In this situation, utopian hopes were nourished, but the road to change was very unclear. In this period, students and youth were not so much reacting against exploitation as they were reacting against bureaucratization and alienation. Not only did classical workers' movements seem unable to address the burning issues for many young radicals, but those movements, as well as the actually existing socialist regimes, seemed to be deeply implicated in precisely the forms of rationalization against which the students and youth were rebelling. The late 1960s then saw a break with the affirmation of abstract universality, particularly in its bureaucratic forms. This new situation suggested the need for a critique that would be a critique both of market-centered capital and of state-centered capital, and implied that the critique of capitalism no longer could be a critique of the market, that the conditions for the future had to be fundamentally rethought. Yet few oppositional movements tried to do this rethinking. Instead, many took a turn to what I would call the conceptually familiar and focused on concrete expressions of domination, such as military violence or bureaucratic police state political domination. Examples of this turn in the late 60s and 70s are concretistic forms of anti-imperialism on the one hand, and the growing focus, and this is by other people, on concrete domination in the communist East on the other. As different and even opposed as these political responses were, both occluded the nature of capitalist domination just when its regime was becoming less tied to states and even more abstract as it emerged as neoliberal global capitalism. Grasping abstract forms of domination in concrete terms went hand in hand with the conception of oppositional politics that itself became increasingly concretistic. Against the historical background of decolonization and anti-colonial wars, especially in Vietnam, anti-colonial struggles now became the primary focus for much of the new left. The concrete nature of such struggles was easy to grasp. Moreover, the struggle of colonized peoples for independence was also felt to have an elective affinity with movements that demanded the recognition of particularity, such as those of minorities and women. In this situation, I want to suggest, anti-colonialism became a displaced way of expressing a radical critique of capitalist society, but translated into nationalist terms. One result has been in the last four decades a fundamental change in the nature of anti-imperialism. During the Vietnam War, for example, opposition to the American War was seen by many as part of a larger struggle for progressive political and social change. The United States was regarded as a conservative force opposed to such change, American opposition to movements of national liberation was criticized particularly strongly, precisely because such movements of national liberation were seen as progressive. The Vietnamese NLF was seen not only as an anti-colonial movement seeking to assert national independence, but also a socialist struggling for a progressive future. Regardless of how one judges such positive evaluations today, what characterized the anti-war movements of a generation ago was that opposition to American policy was one expression of a more general struggle for progressive change. The more recent anti-war mobilizations of a few years ago against the war in Iraq appear at first glance to be the same. But closer consideration reveals, I would argue, that politically they are quite different. Their opposition to the United States has not been in the name of a more progressive alternative. On the contrary, the Ba'ath regime in Iraq, whose oppressive character and brutality far exceeded the regimes of Argentina and Chile in the 1970s, could not be considered progressive on any level. Yet rather than trying to deal with a dilemma, a conflict between an oppressive global imperial power and a brutal fascist regime, on the other hand, the left bracketed the latter in its formulation of anti-war positions. There was not a single massive demonstration in America, Europe, or Australia that featured oppositional left-wing Iraqis. Not a single one. This suggests, however, that mobilizations against the war in Iraq no longer had the same sort of political meaning that the anti-war movement had had earlier. They no longer expressed a larger movement for progressive change. If a generation ago, opposition to American policy entailed supporting struggles for liberation considered progressive, today opposition to American policy in and of itself is often deemed anti-hegemonic simply in itself. In spite of these differences, this shift is, for me, an unfortunate legacy of the dualistic worldview associated with the Cold War. The Cold War category of camp substituted a spatial category for temporal categories of the historical conditions of possibility of transformation. This spatial, essentially dualistic framework helped eradicate from memory the experience of an earlier epoch, the Age of Catastrophe, which showed that opposition to an imperial power is not necessarily progressive. People have really forgotten that there were fascist forms of anti-imperialism as well. This distinction was blurred during the Cold War, in part, and only in part, because the USSR aligned itself with authoritarian regimes, for example, in the Middle East, which had little in common with communist and socialist movements, and indeed usually wiped out their own left. And in this situation, anti-Americanism per se became coded as progressive, though there had been and have been deeply reactionary as well as progressive forms of anti-Americanism. Now, a common feature of the newer anti-imperialism, as I've tried to suggest, has been a reified conflation of the abstract and dynamic domination of global capital with the United States, or at times, the United States and Israel. Although the Bush administration was utterly disastrous, and many Israeli policies have been deeply destructive, this conflation, ironically, recapitulates an ideology of 100 years ago in which the subject positions occupied today by the United States and Israel were occupied by Britain and the Jews. This ideology, however, was a discourse of the European right. The similarity between what had been a rightist critique of hegemony and what regards itself as a critique from the left today reveals similar fetishized understandings of the world. I'm suggesting then that as the concretistic anti-imperialism of the new left fused with the concretistic form of anti-imperialism, of anti-globalization, its attacks on the abstract and universal increasingly recapitulated early anti-Semitic motifs. For parts of the new left, the Palestinian struggle, beginning after 1967, became regarded as the central anti-colonial struggle. What is noteworthy is not support for the Palestinian struggle for self-determination and criticism of Israeli policies and institutions. Rather, it's the degree to which much contemporary discourse on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict exceeds the bounds of political and critical analysis. One does not necessarily, and I've just lost the page. Bear with me for a second. One does not necessarily call into question Palestinian struggles when one knows the degree to which they become emotionally invested for anti-imperialist groups, especially in Europe, and relatedly how invested the critique of Zionism has become. Zionism is frequently treated as a malevolent global force so immensely powerful that it even determines the policies of the American superpower. Historically, this form of anti-Zionism can be related to the situation after 1967, when the Soviet Union, reacting to the defeat of its client states, Egypt and Syria, in the June War, lashed out at Israel by drawing on the anti-Semitic motif formulated earlier during the Shoah trials. The USSR began promulgating a form of anti-Zionism that was essentially anti-Semitic, and it was in this context that all the Jews and the communists who survived in Poland, who were in the Communist Party, were completely purged. Jews who had been communists and anti-Zionists their entire life. Zionism as singularly evil as constituting a global conspiracy. This became adopted by Arab nationalists who changed their rhetoric in line with this, and then by anti-imperialists in the left. A further factor in the re-emergence of anti-Semitic motifs has been the spread and growing importance of the anti-Semitic worldview in the Middle East, and I am not trying to suggest that either the Palestinian struggle in and of itself or criticisms of Israeli policies by Arabs is anti-Semitic. However, and I won't go into detail, there is a great deal of anti-Semitism among the intelligentsia in the Arab world. Israeli policies and actions can help explain very strong anti-Israeli sentiments, but are not sufficient to explain the emergence of a classically anti-Semitic version of anti-Zionism. I want to suggest, and I have to compress here, that these more recent developments could be related to the differential effect globally of neoliberal globalization. Whereas some countries and areas, especially in East and South Asia, have prospered, others, such as Sub-Saharan Africa, have declined precipitously in the last few decades. Less well known is that the Arab-speaking Middle East has suffered precipitous decline. GDP per capita in Saudi Arabia in the early 1980s was $25,000. By the beginning of this millennium, it was $7,000. I don't think you can understand the Arab Spring without understanding this development in the Arab world, which is almost completely ignored by the press. It's not immediately obvious, this decline, why it should be the case. Nevertheless, I would suggest that this regional crisis constitutes the ground for the growing identification of many in the Middle East with the Palestinians as victims and for the spread of anti-Semitic ideas in the region. The notion that Israel and the United States are responsible for the misère of the entire Middle East
helps make sense of the experience of helplessness in the face of protracted regional decline, reinforced by an awareness that some other formerly third world countries have experienced rapid economic growth. This widespread ideology has converged with the fetishized form of anti-globalization described above. One dimension in the shift of the nature of anti-globalization towards de facto anti-Semitism among sections of the anti-imperialist left, and this is particularly relevant for Europe, can be analyzed as the return of the repressed. I would argue that precisely because the Holocaust began to emerge on the surface of consciousness in the 1960s, as a memory and as a theme, counter forces of denial became mobilized that sought to resubmerge the Holocaust, to push it back to the realm of pre-memory. This attempted resubmergence is different from the marginalization of the Holocaust after the war, since it involves denial of what has already emerged on the surface. The result was a form of acting out involving a number of reversals. Much of the new left that emerged out of the new social movement tended to identify with historical victims who were seen as other. This converged with a tendency after 1967 to once again cast the Jews, once again this is within the European context, to cast the Jews as perpetrators. The displacements and rivalries involved, whereby an identity is posited between Israeli Jews and the Nazis, and Palestinians and the true Jews, victims of genocide, helps explain why the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians has been so infected by the European left. Within the framework of such acting out, the Holocaust must be ignored or denied. And that the Holocaust is a stain on European history. It cannot be simply washed away, hence the temptation to deny it. It also, and I think this was clear from the previous talk, disrupts some left understandings of history and politics. In this situation, reductionist left understandings of history and the mechanisms of European historical denial reinforce each other. This is particularly the case with the self-styled anti-imperialist left in Europe, which seeks to locate the possibility of anti-capitalism in non-Western nationalist movements and increasingly in Muslim countries. The collapse of communism has revealed the danger that was always latently present in such concretistic understandings of capitalism. Short of any notion of progressive transformation, the defense of such nationalism reveals itself not only as lacking an adequate conception of capitalism, but also as the expression of conceptual helplessness. Emancipation no longer entails the constitution of a new form of social life, but the elimination of the source of global evil, Zionism, or Zionism in the United States. In other words, it has become very easy for movements that operate within the hollowed-out after-forms of the Cold War to succumb to forms of reification that have long characterized reactionary anti-capitalism. I'm suggesting on an intellectual level that this is one consequence of the continued absence of an adequate critical theory of capitalist modernity today. The absence of such a critique opens the door to fetishized concretistic forms of anti-capitalism and populism, some of which are essentially anti-Semitic. The problematic of the left, anti-capitalism and Zionism, is not simply one of how those issues construed narrowly are dealt with. Rather, it helps illuminate, and in turn is illuminated by, the structuring opposition of abstract universalism and particularism in ways that helps distinguish more adequate critiques of capitalist modernity from those that, from the standpoint of human emancipation, are at best questionable, however many people